talk about Tisha B'Av coming up and how it reflects on our current crisis that we're dealing with. And to use the Gemara Gittin for this, it has a lengthy section, which many of you, I think, are perhaps familiar with, a lengthy section that's devoted to a detailed description and discussion of the Churban HaBayit, the destruction of the Second Temple, the destruction of Yerushalayim, the exile of our people by the Romans. It's a brutally honest discussion. And it has lessons that I think are vitally important for us today when we're wrestling with crises all around us. So the discussion of the Gemara begins with Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan was the great Amora, late second, early third century of the Common Era, great Amora. He lived in this sort of region. He lived in Tzipori, and then he moved to Tveria and set up a major yeshiva there, so this area. And he begins with a paradoxical verse from Mishle, from Proverbs. Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Mai dichtiv, Ashrei Adam mefached tamid, umakshe libo ipol bera'a. Rabbi Yochanan in the Gemara says, what is that which is written in Mishle? Happy is the person who is constantly afraid, but one who hardens his heart shall fall into evil. That's the verse. Happy, fortunate is the person who is always afraid. You know, we don't usually think of fear that way. You know, when it comes to the spiritual emotions, everyone likes love, you know, ahava, but yira and pachad, fear, awe, but real fear, these get overlooked a bit in the spiritual life. But yira, I'm saying yirat Hashem also is included in this. Yira is a necessary component of a full spiritual life. We're not talking here about, you know, frozen, cowering, defensiveness type of fear. You know, fear, the Beit Yaakov of Ishbitz, Rav Yaakov Liner of Ishbitz says, fear is vigilance. Fear is being awake and alert to everything that's going on around you. It's asking yourself at every moment, he says, what is Hashem asking of me in this situation? That's what Yira is about, and Yirat Hashem. You know, ask Hashem at every moment, in every situation, what does Hashem want for me in this situation? So the opposite of fear is not love. They work together. Fear and love are necessary together. If you care about someone, you're also vigilant about what they need and what they want. The opposite of fear is what it says in the second part of the verse from Mishlei. One who hardens their heart shall fall into evil. You know, because fear in the sense is something that keeps us flexible, adaptive to what Hashem asks of us in any situation. And the opposite of that is to be stiff and rigid, stiff attitudes, rigid behaviors. And this is called being hard of heart. And this leads to disaster. And the rest of the Gemara goes on to show that. So Rabbi Yochanan brings this verse. He acknowledges it's paradoxical. And he answers his own question. What's this about? He says, the example of those who were not fearful and who hardened their hearts and fell into evil were members of the generation of the destruction of the temple, and the destruction at the time of the Bar Kokhba revolts. You know, this is in 70 of the Common Era and in the 130s of the Common Era afterwards. And this led to terrible death and destruction because they were hard of heart. And he describes the events that went on here in an unusual way. He kind of summarizes them, and you're perhaps familiar with the statement. Kamtzu bar kamtza churuv Yerushalayim, atarnigol atarnigolta churuv tor malka, ashaka derispak churuv beitar. Over kamtza and bar kamtza, two enemies, Jerusalem was destroyed. Over a rooster and a hen, tor malka was destroyed. And over the pole of a palanquin, beitar was destroyed. Wait a second. The destruction of Yerushalayim and Tur Malka, which is in the Sharon plain, or the coastal plain of Eretz Israel, and Beitar, which is in the area of the Gush, where Beitar Elite is now. These were major disasters during the oppressive Roman occupation of Israel. and they had complex military and political causes and backgrounds, very difficult situation. What, is Rabbi Yochanan only suggesting here very trivial causes for major events? But actually, Rabbi Yochanan is waking us up. There is deep, deep wisdom and insight here in this sugya and in this statement. On one level, it's sort of along the lines of the saying of Benjamin Franklin, was a American politician. Franklin said, "For want of a nail, the horseshoe was lost. A nail fell out of the horseshoe was lost. For want of a horseshoe, the horse was lost. For want of a horse, the rider was lost. For want of a rider, the battle was lost. For want of the battle, a kingdom was lost." And for all of that for the lack of a horseshoe nail. Okay, so the point is that small mistakes, little things can snowball into major disasters, kind of a chaos theory in a certain sense. So that's one level of Rabbi Yochanan's statement, but also he's talking on a much, much deeper level. He's saying that the attitudes and the behaviors that were exemplified in these three stories, which he goes on to talk about, were typical of the mindset of the Jews of that time. And this mindset, a hardness of heart and a hardness of head, did lead to disaster. Now, so you probably know the story of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa. Bar Kamsa is insulted at a party. He's embarrassed by the host. Many rabbis are present and they don't step in to make peace. Bar Kamsa, who's a Jew, has contacts in the Roman government, and he falsely accuses the Jews of revolting against Rome. He's so angry. His anger just carries him away. And he offers to prove this charge that the Jews are revolting by bringing a sacrifice from Rome to be offered at the Beit HaMikdash. And he says that, and the Jews, you'll see, the Jews won't offer it. Now, this itself was not a problem. Korbanot, sacrifices from the nations, were accepted. They were offered in the Beit HaMikdash as a regular thing, as long as they followed the Torah criteria of the sacrifice. But Bar Kamsa puts a blemish, a pagam, in the sacrifice that disqualified it for the Beit HaMikdash, but the Romans would not have thought that this was a serious blemish. Well, when the sacrifice arrives, Shalayim to the Beit HaMikdash, the rabbis see the problem and they discuss what to do. It's an emergency. Many lives are on the line. Many lives could be lost. The whole nation could be lost here if Rome is insulted. So they have two choices. The rabbis realize they have two choices. They can either offer the sacrifice with a blemish, or they can kill Bar Kamsa, who is a traitor, he's an informer, he's a moser. He's liable to death penalty. So they have two choices. And the halacha would allow for either one of those choices in this time of pikuach nefesh, of an emergency danger to life, danger to the entire nation. The halacha would have allowed that. But among the rabbis, there was this rigidly pious rabbi, Rabbi Zecharia ben Avkolis, very rigid kind of guy. And he objected to having a blemished sacrifice offered. You can't offer a blemished sacrifice at the Beit HaMikdash. Can't be makel, lenient on sacrifices. It will set a bad precedent for people. What will people say? And he objects to killing Bar Kamsa because people might make another halachic mistake, which is a thinking that a blemished sacrifice is a capital crime. So Rabbi Zecharia ben Avkolis focuses on little halachic details, little issues of halacha, totally oblivious to the emergency pikuach nefesh situation that they're in, and disaster is looming from the Romans. And as Rabbi Yochanan describes it, the rabbis don't have the guts to take the strong actions that were needed and to overrule Rabbi Zecharia ben Avkolis. And instead they just do nothing. The sacrifice is not offered because of a small technicality. Rome is insulted. They think the Jews really are revolting, and the attack begins, the horrific attack. Rabbi Yochanan sums all this up. Rabbi Yochanan, the great teacher, sums all this up saying, "Amar Rabbi Yochanan, anvetanuto shel Rabbi Zecharia ben Avkolis, hechriva et betenu, v'sarfa et hechalenu, higlitanu miatzenu." the excessive, rigid, pious inaction, as Rashi says, the excessive, rigid, pious inaction of Rabbi Zechariah ben Apkolos destroyed our house, our Beit HaMikdash, burnt our temple, and exiled us from our land. Rabbi Yochanan's point is that this was an emergency. The Romans were violent occupiers. The Torah has flexibility when it comes to emergencies. And either of those two options would have been fine, but the rabbis focused on petty things instead of being vigilant and paying attention to the reality that they were facing, the big picture. The next case, the case of the rooster and the hen, was that the community of Tur Malka, and it's in the coastal plain of Eretz Israel, sort of north of Caesarea today. They had a custom of putting a rooster and a hen in front of a chatan bekala at a chatana as a segula, you know, a little superstitious custom saying, may you be fruitful like chickens. You know, they had the chickens dance in front of them. I don't know if that's a good thing, fruitful like chickens, but whatever. They considered a segula. So some years after the Khorban of the temple, after the destruction, we're talking now in the 130s of the Common Era, when the oppression of Rome was even getting worse, that could be, there was a certain chatuna, there was a wedding going on, and they were putting out the rooster and the hen in front of the chatan bekala. And just at that moment, a troop of Roman soldiers who were hungry came by. They saw the rooster and the hen. They grabbed them for food. And the Jews at the wedding were angry that their little custom, this little minhag that they had, was being ruined, and they attacked the Roman troop and beat them. Which the Roman troop then reported back to Rome that the Jews were revolting again, and this led to a devastating war and tremendous, tremendous loss of life. Horrific. The third case is called the pole of the palanquin. The palanquin is a litter, they call it litter. It's like a couch with two poles on either side, and a wealthy person would sit on the couch, and slaves, four slaves, you know, would hold the ends of the pole, and they would walk. You've seen such a thing, or seen pictures, maybe. Palanquin is called a litter. So the story is that the Jews of Beitar, in the Gush region where we are today, had a custom that when a baby boy was born, they would plant a cedar tree. And when a baby girl was born, they planted a pine tree. When the children grew and were about to get married, they would cut down the trees and use the wood for the poles of the chuppah. Very nice custom, but a minhag. So also in the 130s, one of Caesar's daughters was passing through Beitar in a palanquin, and the pole of the palanquin broke. And the people that were carrying it looked around for a tree to make a pole, and they cut down one of the cedar trees that was supposedly set aside for the Jewish marriage custom. And the Jews of Beitar got angry and attacked the daughter of Caesar and the escort with her. And the daughter complained to Caesar and that the Jews were revolting, and the Romans devastated the people and the land completely. A horrific, horrific description in the Gemara. Right. These are the key stories that Rabbi Yochanan brings us, many other tragic stories woven in. You get a sense from this long and heartbreaking section that the Jews of that time, with all the danger that was facing them, were just sleepwalking. They weren't realizing the crises that they were in. Some just wanted to conduct business as usual while people were starving and being slaughtered around them. Some wanted to keep little firm customs or believe that if they kept certain rituals, God would protect them. Some had no perspective at all. They attacked the Romans over trivial issues. Some believed with total certainty that God was on their side. So they set fire to all their own provisions and food in Jerusalem during a siege in order to get people to go out and fight. And they lost disastrously. And the rabbinic leadership of the time mostly was weak and ineffectual, and rigidly pious and rigid pious behavior brought death and disaster. There was one hero in all of this. And if I have a minute or two just to finish this up. Yeah. There's one hero in all of this, in this amazing sugya, Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai. He's the Gadol Hador, the great leader of the Prushim, a Gadol of vision and wisdom and flexibility. He risked his life to escape from the siege of Jerusalem and to negotiate with the general Vespasian. he impresses the Roman general, and the Roman general grants him three favors. Now, Vespasian is intent on destroying Yerushalayim. He's going to destroy the Beit HaMikdash. He's not going to budge from that. But short of that, three favors to Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. So Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai tries to save what can be saved of the Jews and of Torah life of that time. And what he asks for is significant. He asks that the town of Yavne and its sages and its rabbis be spared to become a place of Torah study. And it does. He asks that the lineage of Rabban Gamliel, the Nasi, which is the lineage, you know, good Torah leadership that ultimately leads to the Mashiach b'mehar b'yameinu, that lineage be spared. And he asks that doctors come to heal Rabbi Tzadok. Rabbi Tzadok had been fasting on behalf of all of Am Yisrael, that this terrible crisis that he saw was going on would be averted. And unfortunately, it didn't work. And Rabbi Tzadok got very sick, so Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai asked for doctors to heal him. Well, in this case, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, you know, he's criticized by some of the rabbis in the Gemara, but the Gemara stands by him. I mean, he got the situation. He understood the crisis. He stepped up with great courage. He knew it was a time for Am Yisrael to adapt and to shift. It had to shift away from the Beit HaMikdash and Korbanot. They weren't going to be able to offer them anymore. So they had to shift to Torah learning on a serious, high, moral, spiritual level, which is what they needed anyway, because the Jews had already destroyed the Beit HaMikdash themselves. They had treated Korbanot, I know you've been learning about Korbanot, they had treated Korbanot as a kind of cheap way to get kapara, to get atonement for sins, and then go back and keep on sinning. You know, so the Jews had already destroyed the meaning of the Beit HaMikdash. The Midrash says that when the Romans destroyed it, they ground up flour that was already ground by the Jews. The lineage of the Nasi, Rabban Gamliel, to have real good Torah leadership, political leadership, and Rabbi Tzadok, the importance of having Jews who feel for all of Am Yisrael, of all of Am Yisrael in our hearts. So Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai knew what he was asking for. He knew that he had to change course, the whole course of Am Yisrael at that time. No more Beit HaMikdash. Okay. Even Jerusalem was no longer the center for a while. And they had to travel around with the Sanhedrin around Eretz Yisrael. Okay. He saved Am Yisrael mamash. And the fact that we're here today, even on Zoom today, learning, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is at the heart of it. So when we learn this devastating account of the destruction of the temple, the death and exile of our people, we can't help but be struck by the way the Jews of that time were oblivious to the emergency crisis that they were in. They were sleepwalking, concerned with trivialities, superstitions, rituals, magical thinking, little frumkites, rigid thinking. They thought because they learned Torah, God would protect them. They vacillate back and forth. They wrapped up in their own little issues, their own little egos, while a dangerous reality is all around them. They hardened their hearts. They fell into evil. And frankly, it sounds unsettlingly familiar. You can find almost every category of rigidity that the Gemara lists then around us today. People who are not adapting to the dangerous reality of the coronavirus. They just want to go on with irresponsible behavior, hedonism, irresponsible protests. Protests are okay, but when they get violent, they're not okay. They go people that want to go on with magical thinking or irresponsible rituals, large gatherings for smachot, even when it leads to illness and death, Rahman al-Islam. And all this while vicious enemies are all around us waiting for any sign of weakness to let all the missiles fly. Rahman al-Islam. We're sleepwalking. So we need Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai today. A leader of wisdom, realism, flexibility, vision, who's able to wake people up, guide people to a more mature approach to Torah, to real and honest leadership, to help each of us have the welfare of all of us in our hearts, like Rabbi Tzadok. Well, at least each of us needs to step up and be a leader in this time. We can set an example for other people and support each other by wearing masks properly, not under your chin or dangling from your ear, as I say some people on the street, wear them properly, covering the nose and the mouth. You want to protect not just yourself, but other people as well. Rebbe Tzadok, that's the spirit. We can keep proper physical distance, maintain good hygiene, avoid silly and trivial and risky behavior, certain rituals that we know are dangerous to do. You know, we have to wake up and recognize that we're in a serious crisis. There's a virus within, there's dangerous enemies all around. So this Tisha B'Av is not just a sad time of commemoration of the past. It's urgently, urgently relevant to our crisis today. And if we learn its lessons deeply, it can help wake us up. Bezat Hashem, may we wake up before it's too late. May we learn all the lessons from this crisis that we need to learn. Follow good practices of health and hygiene, discipline and maturity, patience, lev tov with a good heart, with achdut, you know, with unity together, to protect each other, to support each other, to make it safely through all these crises, Be'ezrat Hashem. We all have a meaningful, deep, and a tikkun of a Tisha B'Av this year, Be'ezrat Hashem.
Wow, thank you so much. Rabbi Sender, can I ask you two questions? One is, where's that the Gemara that you quoted initially?
It's the Gemara Gittin. Nun Hei Amad Bet Amad Aleph. So it's 55b on. It's for it goes on for several
Okay, yeah. Thank you. The other question I wanted to ask is, you know, lots of times it's not really clear when the moment is to be stringent and when is the moment to be you know, less stringent. I mean, it's not a simple question.
Right. It's true. Sometimes you want to be firm in something and sometimes you want to be flexible. But this is where, you know, real Torah learning comes in. I mean, real Torah learning. The Gemara, in our case, for instance, has many, many discussions about how to deal with a dever or a magefa, with a plague, which, you know, which is an epidemic, a pandemic of their time. Many good discussions about it. All of it with excellent advice that is as relevant today as it was then. Social distancing, you know, protecting each other. I mean, not going, Gemara says, in time of plague, don't go into a Beit HaKnesset, don't go into a shul. So if we learn the Gemara properly with a sense of realism, not just projecting principle, but a real sense of realism, because the Gemara is about being real. You have to see the situation you're in, evaluate it accurately, understand the nature of a virus, and how to protect yourself, and then find the Gemara passages, if you want to do it that way, that will tell you what to do. And the Gemara will always have the right wisdom on this. To pretend that you know, that sitting in a Beit HaKnesset protects you, when the Gemara says it does not, you know, where does that come from? You know, that's magical thinking. You can sit in the Beit. No one's saying not to learn or not to daven, but learn and pray with proper distancing. You know, with proper precautions. You should learn even harder. So it doesn't have to be, you know, tzafuf, everyone, you know, you get the point. In other words, the Gemara teaches us how to analyze it properly. It teaches us how to analyze reality. It teaches us realism, not fantasy thinking, not magical thinking. And unfortunately, I think there's been a degeneration of that in the last 100 years. The Gemara attunes us to reality. And then we get a sense of when you need to be flexible and when you need to, you know, be a little bit tough. I mean, that's a general answer. Every situation, the Beit Yaakov says, in every situation, you have to ask Hashem, what are you asking of me in this situation? And be flexible. He says, to follow one path is not the Torah way, he says. You have to be flexible. That's the Beit Yaakov. It's amazing.
Okay. Thank you very much. And we all really enjoyed your Divrei Torah. Appreciate it very much.
Great to be with all of you.
Hope again soon. Thank you. Okay, we're going to take these last few minutes and we're going to continue our study of the laws of Shabbos. We've been doing the Malacha of Malavein, which we said is defined as cleaning any absorbent material. Okay, so does not apply to, we talked about the fact that it does not apply to materials that are non-absorbent, hard surfaces, which is why you are allowed to wash dishes. In Malabin, there are actually three processes that that are included in the Malacha Malabin. Someone is someone's like really okay, so these three processes are called Sharia, Shifshuf, Sharia meaning soaking, Shifshuf means scrubbing, and Schita meaning squeezing, which actually, if you think about it, those are basically the functions of a normal washing machine, right? You've got your soaking cycle, and then you've got your agitation cycle, the Shifshuf, and then you've got, you know, rinse and spin. So it's all pretty much the same. It's all those processes involved in a washing machine are the things that are that different ways that a person could violate the malacha of Malabein. Okay, so we're going to look at each one of them. Okay, so the malacha of Sharia basically is saturating any cloth, any fabric. Okay, even if you put something in water, even if all the material doesn't, all the stain doesn't come out, all the dirt doesn't come out, doesn't matter. You've still done this. It's still putting it in the liquid is what is prohibited. Right, like even like wetting a material or like something's wrinkled and you want to spray it to get the wrinkles out. I think actually this is a really hard malacha. This to me is like really one of the hardest malachas because, you know, here you've got your like brand new beautiful blouse that you just bought for Shabbos, and you know, and you take a little bite out of your beets, and beet falls off the fork and onto your beautiful blouse and goes all the way down. And what you can do about it on Shabbos is nothing. There's nothing that you can do about it. And so, I mean, it's like there are certain instances where you have to be really strong to observe Shabbos. And this is definitely one of those things, you know, to see, you know, just to not be able to do anything. So you can't soak it and you can't do anything to clean that stain. So what happens if, we're black. Good point. I try and do that. Okay, so what happens if you've spilled over a glass of water on Shabbos and the water's all over your table? Like, you have to leave it there? No, you can't take a towel, a piece of cloth to mop it up, because that's exactly, even though your intention is not to clean the cloth that you're using to wipe it up, you can't wet a cloth. You cannot take a white cloth and wipe it up. What you can do though is the rabbis are lenient about using paper, because the malacha malabim, the reason why you're wetting something is to clean it. But something like a napkin, basically you have no intent, you're not doing anything to the napkin. You're gonna wet it, you're gonna throw it out. You're not doing anything to preserve it or to restore it or to improve its condition. You're just basically trying to get the water up, and you're gonna basically throw it out. So if you do have that situation where something does spill, then what you're allowed to do is to take a paper towel that's been pre-cut or tissues or a napkin, and you're allowed to wipe it up. But what you cannot do is take any kind of a cloth and use that to wipe it up. Okay, so that's about it for now. That is it, and that is all. Somebody said, can you blot up something that's like a stain that's on your clothes? No, black is a good idea. You can't blot a stain. You can't do anything. Even if by wiping it, you're not even going to get all the stain off, you can't do anything to clean it up. Like I said, it's a hard malacha.
Can I ask you a question, okay, Judy?
Please.
And did you tell us maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago we cannot like bite off hangnails or something?
Yeah.
Thank you very much. I have this bad habit many years, and every time last week or two, I'm about to do it. I think, wait, Judy said we're not allowed to.
Right. I have a bad habit. I have a bad habit with that too, and it's my biggest struggle with the Hilchos Shabbos. I'm like constantly, no. So it's anyway.
Thank you. I don't remember learning it before 2 weeks ago. Thank you.
Okay. Can you rub it or scratch it off? No, you can't do anything really to remove the stain. There's just not, you put on your robe, which you wore last week, and you didn't notice that there's like some dried food on it. Well, a very simple thing. Just take your thumb and scratch it off. No, you, there's just about nothing that you can do. If you're sopping wet, you know, I guess you could blot it with paper, but you can't, if your intention is to clean up the stain, you, there's really nothing that you can do on Shabbos with that. Like I said, it's a tough one. Okay,
Judy,
yes.
I wanted to know, you said hard surfaces are okay to wipe. So does that mean that you can sweep the floor and squeegee it?
Squeegee it, you can squeegee it. Just what do you do with the water afterwards? If you're squeegeeing it out to your garden, it's a problem. If you're squeegeeing it into a hole in the middle of your, then it's probably okay. So you could do that. Sweeping is not a problem. And certainly washing dishes if they're for, you know, Shabbos use is not a problem. For other uses, it's a little more complicated. Okay. So a couple of announcements. So this is our last class until Rosh Chodesh, till after Rosh Chodesh Elul, which is August 24th, we'll be resuming. Okay, Elul is pretty early this year. All of September we'll be involved in. And I don't know. I'm waiting to hear if any of you have any feelings one way or the other about going back live. I have a feeling that we're going to at least be for Elul in over Zoom, which I'm quite sorry about, but Zoom is a wonderful thing too. But just be nice to see everybody together. So that's when we'll be returning. Of course, this Thursday we have a day of learning. Everybody, I hope got a flyer, got the schedule, got a link. We'll be on Zoom starting at 10 o'clock, and we really have a wonderful program. Really, some wonderful speakers. It's a very Baruch Hashem. It's a very good lineup, so we have. We're reading Eicha in English. We're doing. We have Shevachaya. We have Rabbi Mervis. We have Riva. We have Rabbi Gamedzi. Then at 2 o'clock, the presentation from the Chavetz Chaim Foundation that's shown every year through Miriam and Ilana's auspices. So there are no live. There are no group presentations, so we'll be screening that at starting at hopefully 2 o'clock. That'll be the time that it's starting, and I think that's my the only message. Anybody else have any announcements?
I have a question.
Yes.
Sarah Hudi Schneider doing, is that going to be in English too, or is that in Hebrew? You posted it that she was going to have Eicha
right. The Eicha at night is read in Hebrew. It's quite beautiful. I went many years when I was in Yerushalayim. It's really quite beautiful. I said this to somebody, when a man lanes, there's no halakha problem with a woman laning this for other women. But when a man lanes, he's like laning. When a woman is laning, it's like crying. And especially Chana Yaffe is beautiful voice, and so she lanes even just to hear it and not to understand it. It's a very beautiful thing. So if you can make it, and then of course after that, Sari Yudit will be speaking. And here's this. Okay, and so that's, I think it starts promptly at 9 o'clock on Wednesday night. So the fast starts at 7:34, okay, and the fast ends at 7:58. And of course, everybody is advised to drink as much as they can, even starting, should be drinking quite a lot today. And you should be drinking, you know, as much as you can over the next couple of days. And then, you know, we have our Sudat Mafseket. We have a final Suda before the last Suda, which we eat sitting separately, sitting on the floor, eat an egg dipped in ashes. Then we have a long, warm day ahead on Tisha B'Av. Maybe we won't have it. Maybe only, you know, Miriam's clapping. Okay. This year we're not going to have it. Some year we're not going to have it. It's going to turn into the moed that it's been meant to be. Okay, we got to go to some other classes. Goodbye, everybody. See you.
Thank you, Judy. Thank you.
Okay.
Bye. Thank you. Bye.